and the fundamental principles of what America is supposed to be is why my parents left Vietnam and came here, and how they've been able to have 5 successful kids, who, by the way, were on welfare and WIC and had free lunch program and all those things. But how do you survive without some of that? Because the country's bigger than that. And so if the question is today whether our country is still big enough in our hearts to do that for people, then it matters.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I recently spoke with Larry Huynh. Larry is one of the founders of Trilogy Interactive, one of the top firms that provides digital strategy, creative, and technical consulting to progressive candidates, causes, and issues. Trilogy was born of a merger of 3 firms, BlackRock, Mayfield Strategies, and Articulated Man. Larry has a great life story, from refugee camp to Harvard to longtime advisor to leading politicians, and he has a lot of expertise in the space to share. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Larry Huynh and Trilogy Interactive.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Larry. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Larry Huynh. I live out in Berkeley, California with my partner and 2 kids. Currently, I am a founding partner at Trilogy Interactive. We're a digital consulting firm with a focus in political and public affairs.
And from what I remember, you got your start in politics with the draft Wesley Clark campaign back in the day, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, if you think about how long ago it was, you know, the work that we started doing in politics and in the digital space, yeah, it was 2003. Brent, my partner and I, we were both sort of in between things. I was actually on disability at the time, and we were looking at the field, right? The last existential threat to America, which was in 2003, 2004, which seemed serious, and it was, but just seems so far away and different than this current threat, was George W. Bush. And so a number of us who were either at the time or subsequently realized the huge mistakes of the Iraq War and Democrats sort of falling in line, frankly, playing politics instead of voting the way that some of them thought they should vote. And then we're looking for alternatives than what was out in the field. And so our friend Jason reached out to Brent. Jason had worked with Brent. Brent was an intern on Clinton Gore 96, I think, and said, "Hey, I heard that there's this general, he's considering running for president." It's interesting because he's just really strong voice against the war, and that's a good messenger, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so as we thought about it, and it was interesting, we started seeing and noticing the just movement online that was happening there, that was just happening very organically. And we're like, okay, well, let's jump in and see what we can do and apply our interest in politics, though not our specific craft yet in politics, but our craft in working on high-tech marketing into this political space. And so we jumped in and helped with the draft movement. And then when he eventually got into the race, just jumped into the campaign and started working on the campaign.
It seemed like that campaign was ahead somehow in digital politics. It had attracted a lot of talented people in tech, and as the Dean campaign at the same time had. Why do you think that was?
there's a natural tendency, I think, in terms of tech, of being somewhat on the outside and thinking about things in a different way and not beholden to the beltway and the inside DC way of doing things. That was one. And two, people found each other online, right? That was the venue of which people discovered that there was a shared interest and shared purpose. That's really powerful. It was organized online. It wasn't funded by any sort of big entity or traditional entity. It was people putting in their time and effort, and it happened all online. So you're going to attract people who are spending a lot of time online. And even in 2003, it's still relatively early in the life cycle of things. It's pre-really any social media of any kind. And so you're using like Yahoo groups of things to organize and email and then online to offline. So it was interesting, the talent we got, but it came from all over the place and they would just show up in Little Rock.
Now you had like, I don't know what, biochem or something like that at Harvard. What had you been doing before the campaign that prepared you for doing digital politics?
I'm just a little weird in that way in general. I was biochem at Harvard because I was interested, and it was, for me, the last chance to learn something. I had no intention of using it in my career. I had had actually a couple internships on Wall Street over my time at Harvard. So I said, oh, I have a job, so let me just do what I want to do in school, and the job stuff will take care of itself.
Because most people don't randomly do something like biochemistry.
No, most people don't. And, you know, my classmates were convinced. You know,
that you would go on and
No, there's all kinds of stereotypes, right? Oh, you're Asian. You're just going to be a doctor. You're just making your parents happy. You just can't admit it to yourself type thing.
And would your parents have been happy with it?
Oh, my God. If I became a doctor, yes.
As opposed to a successful businessman and political strategist.
That's fine, too. But they don't understand. You know, they didn't. What is this? What is working in politics? What is having a business in politics? They don't understand that. They see a doctor on a regular basis. They get that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they
understand. And there's a lot of status
from that. Status, but also understand that it comes from hard work and comes from effort. But I don't. I can deal with my blood. I can't deal with anyone else's blood. So no, it was never my intention, despite my classmates, because they were like, why would you put yourself through the torture? And I was just a little odd duck that way. And it was great. I'm really glad I did it. It was my last chance to learn something outside of what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
I became friends with one of your partners, Josh Ross,
during the
08 campaign.
And
he tells me that you have a really good life story, which what is he referring to in that? Like,
my family is from Vietnam. My dad was senior military officer in the South. I learned more about this over time, but as the war was progressing and the North was just slowly moving south, my parents with my three sisters and brother, my mom was pregnant with me at the time, just kept moving from city to city and moving farther and farther south because they're just trying to get away from the northern forces that were sort of making their way down. So fall of Saigon in April, 75, you can imagine it's chaos. And my dad and mom had plans and sort of methods to get them out if things went to hell, which they were. And they get there and, you know, things aren't the way you plan. So nothing is available. They can't find their way out. At some point, they eventually work their way to the water where there are some boats and things like that. And by the time they get there, all the boats had left, American boats and things like that. And in the interim, my aunt had found my mother. She is a teenager, and she ran to my mother, and she's like, I'm leaving with you. I can't stay because they're just bombs, and it's just crazy. And she couldn't deal with it, and so she just sort of made her own personal life decision just to go along with my parents. And so they had my aunt, who's a teenager, and my sisters, who are I think probably 6'5", 3", or, you know, and my brother 2, and then my mom's about 8 months pregnant. And they get there, and they see the boats in the distance, and my dad just sort of does all he can. He takes off his shirt and starts waving it. And one of the boats, American boats, decides to turn around and comes back, grabs our family. And then, you know, away we went. And they ended up in the Philippines first. Then they ended up in Arkansas, a refugee camp. Fort Chaffee, Arkansas is where they were. And then I was born at 10 months. I'm sure my mom just sort of was like holding out as much as possible, trying to get to a place where it's a little bit safer. And then I was born in a refugee camp in Arkansas.
So many Americans have stories like that. It's not that many of them that start in a refugee camp and end up at Harvard, though. What did your family do to put you in a position where you could be a good student and have that route?
Yeah, it's interesting. And so I should talk about this later. I would have written a very different application. I didn't know that mattered, right? It's just my life.
Yeah.
So I never used any of it when I applied to school and never told that story when it just wasn't. Now I understand the game a little bit more. So maybe Felicity Huffman should have reached out to me and I could have helped her.
Well, it seems like you had other things going for you than that drama.
But yeah, no, I was the youngest of five. My parents worked a lot and they didn't have a time. But I had siblings who took care of me and I just had the freedom because of that. For a family that didn't have much, we didn't have much money growing up. But there wasn't ever a sense that we weren't stable. The environment was stable. We had enough to live for sure, to the extent that you can be spoiled on very low income. I was probably somewhat spoiled and had siblings who all took care of me. And so I just had that luxury and that freedom to just pursue what I wanted to pursue. I don't think I had any sense that I was disadvantaged. Though in reality, I was.
Did your parents speak English?
Not much. Yeah. Not much. They get through the day, but they don't speak a ton of English. They did jobs like being janitors or housekeepers, and those were the things that they ended up doing. My dad ended up getting, when we were in Houston, a manufacturing job. We actually were in Reston, Virginia first. We left the refugee camp, ended up here a couple years because that's where our sponsors were. And as you know, there's a big community out here in Virginia, a Vietnamese community, and mom and dad still have friends out here, and my sisters have friends out here. And then we moved to Houston. Obviously, at the time, late 70s, it's a booming economy before it all sort of crashed. So they went out there for opportunity. My mom didn't like the snow here, and she didn't deal with snow much in Vietnam. She had concerns that I was getting sick a lot. So we went down there, and I just had amazing opportunities and just sort of having the freedom to be a kid. My dad always really pushed me to all of us to do well in school. He bribed us, which I look back on as being a perfectly acceptable thing to do because I don't think I would have cared about school except I was going to get some money if I got straight A's. And so then at some point he cut me off, but it had been built into my DNA and I couldn't stop.
Sure.
And so, I just worked hard and never thought I didn't have an opportunity. I had great teachers. I was in public school. They just let me push myself. And, there's a part of me that it's natural, but I had the access and the ability to do it from my parents, my family, and school.
And I assume your parents were educated people if your dad was a military officer.
They don't talk about it much. I mean, my dad read a lot, so it's always unclear to me exactly their specific education. They've never really gotten into those details with me, but certainly they're both really bright in different ways. And I probably benefit from both of them in that way. My mom's very detail-oriented and probably analytic. My dad's very verbal and just reads a lot, and I sort of got both of those things, fortunately. And yes, my dad's emphasis on education clearly came from somewhere, though he was off on his own pretty young, and he sort of got that was important and instilled it upon me. I may have been the one that went to Harvard, but all my siblings graduated college, so it's...
When did you meet Brent?
Harvard. Yeah. So Brent's a year older. We sang in the Harvard Glee Club. So that's how we met each other.
And then you went both to the Clark campaign.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did. So we were in Little Rock.
What do you think was the main thing that you learned in that Clark for President campaign about politics and and campaigning?
People in politics, all of us on some level, are susceptible to wanting to believe that we're smarter than we are. And at some level, we are at the mercy of the voters. And things change very quickly. So you can go from leading in the race and then pulling back like he did, a couple missteps early in the race for the campaign, and then the general stabilizing the campaign, being in good shape heading into December, and then the results in Iowa completely being a surprise result. And once that surprise result happens, it's an avalanche. And you can't control any of that.
There's a lot of chaos.
Right. You can't control that. And you have all these plans, but you can't control for that scenario. The scenario where Dean doesn't win and John Kerry winning and John Edwards getting into the top three, and then all of a sudden the narrative is about two candidates no one was really talking about anymore. And so the narrative of talking about Dean and Clark all of a sudden disappears for two new candidates. And you can think you're as smart as anyone, and at some point that just happens and you're at the mercy of it.
Makes you wonder whether we're going to be like in 2020 with the same top three. We just don't know, right?
Right. Right. And people, I just obviously in our business, everyone's just talking about it. And it's like, well, you don't know what's going to happen. And you think you're going to know what's happening. And
but it's great to be the fire.
Yeah. It's also, it's great to be the front runner. It's also the scrutiny of a front runner. So your mistakes get amplified. We have front runners who, Bernie Sanders just had a heart attack. How are you going to predict that? Joe Biden is not consistent as a candidate. He just hasn't had to run a tough race in decades. And the scrutiny of that is tough. And if they hold up against it, great. That means they've survived it. But that doesn't always happen. It usually doesn't, right, in Democratic primaries. So yeah, I learned that, you know, we're never as smart as we think we are. And we have to be okay with that, which is sometimes hard. But then at the same time, I also learned that there are just a lot of good people doing this. And you make, in a presidential in particular, just lifelong friends that it's amazing what it's like being in that sort of bunker together for a short amount of time, even if it's 5-6 months, how formative that is. And so one of the most formative experiences of my life, along with a few other things.
I don't doubt it at all. You come out of that campaign and start a consulting business called BlackRock, which I remember hearing about when I was also in the business to some degree.
Uh-huh.
What was the founding story there?
So campaign's ending. We're all in Tennessee. Lots of emotions. And at some point in Tennessee, and maybe even back in Little Rock as well, I think just a couple of our friends who worked with us, and they said, well, this is kind of different. What you're doing is different. Would you have any interest in doing this in politics? And it just never occurred to us to do that. We just thought we were going to go back and find some other startup. I need to actually finish my disability, all that stuff. But that was, the seed was planted by our friends on the campaign. We took maybe a couple months off, February, March. Pretty good ski season, if I recall. So I think we skied a lot and just sort of clearing our heads. And at some point in April, said, oh, well, we probably need a job. And what do you think about just doing this? And so we thought about it and we just started doing it. And
who was your first client?
Barbara Boxer.
How do you land Barbara Boxer as your first client when you're starting a firm?
It's the benefit of being early on in this, right? Yeah. And we're in California. This traces back to the Clark campaign. So Katie Merrill is a friend of ours. She was on the Clark campaign for a very short period of time. We remember watching, I think the Giants were in the playoffs, and we were watching it on the TV together. Katie was working on Barbara's campaign, her reelect. Katie knew we were starting a firm. And yeah, we're doing this. And Katie's like, well, let me pitch the campaign. See if they're willing to try this. This would be new. No one, yeah, especially certainly on the Democratic side, but I think at all was really doing any of this for anything other than the presidentials. And the senator and campaign manager, Rose Kapelczynski, decided to take a chance. And they took a chance on us. And we landed Barbara Boxer, and then relatively soon after that, ended up working for Blanche Lincoln's reelect. Senator from Arkansas. So we had the Arkansas.
Kind of starting right at the top of the game here.
So Arkansas relationships and California relationships, and very different profiles online, which we learned that, you know, your profile online and your politics makes a big difference on how effective you can be online. But yeah, we started there, and it was really just us doing what we learned on the campaign and what we learned in our business lives, just marketing, email marketing. We start doing it and went well. I remember Senator Boxer's had this amazing direct mail fundraising program, but they did it all in-house and Barbara always wrote it. And at some point the campaign came to us and said, hey, Barbara likes your content and she wants you to write the direct mail, which was like a huge sign that like, oh, we actually kind of know what we're doing here because she's willing to let us do something that actually she does versus something they don't understand and just let some.
Who was she running against that year?
What was his name? Generic, older white man, Bill Jones, I think. Oh, God. Something like that.
Doesn't matter.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah. Was that the year when there were two, both Feinstein and Boxer were up?
Or No. At that point, they got elected together.
Right. Yeah, and then
They got back on cycle.
Got it.
Yeah.
Were those the only two that you did in that particular?
We helped a couple for a nonprofit that were political. Mm-hmm. We did a couple projects like that, but those were the main things we were doing. We helped a little bit with General Clark stuff afterwards, as he was still able to raise significant amount of money for other candidates, particular Senate candidates, that cycle, though that ended up being a slaughter for us in general. I think we lost practically every single important Senate race that cycle.
And so how did that feel as a business? Did you feel like we're onto something here? Did you like the work? Did you like the way the business was taking off? What was that?
Yeah, no, it was fun.
Yeah.
And it was clearly viable on some level. And we were doing something new. It is not new at all, but at the time it was new. So we felt like we were doing something important beyond just this immediate campaign. We were establishing an industry and an important function within campaigns that didn't exist before. But we didn't know. We had to get through the cycle.
Yeah.
And then
do the work.
Then what happens when all the campaigns are gone?
Yeah.
So that ended up being a different question.
When I talk to digital strategists in that general era, there was always this, well, there's often this kind of crankiness that they weren't in the main councils of the campaign.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
sure.
Like we're not at the table. You know, we're
That's
we're
still kind of, true it's, for many.
Yeah. Can you sort of trace how that was evolving, the role of the digital strategist?
People don't get it. So how are they going to put you at the table when they don't even understand what you're doing?
Yeah. Regular political people were not getting this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just sort of were like, okay, well, let's just try it. This is what it was in 2004.
It's more like you're a direct mail vendor than you're someone who should be thinking about the strategy of the
campaign.
Right.
They don't think that realize every email is a de facto press release. Everyone gets it. Say something stupid in an email, it can become press. Yeah. And people don't understand that. So I think that's still ever evolving. The issue is, I think it's a problem, frankly, because the world is very digital and campaigns in terms of their advisors are not still. So I don't think that's changed some. You're in the room for many conversations and the advanced campaigns have you in the room for the most important conversations. So we would be in like relatively soon, 2006, more so 2008, at the important strategy meetings, important consultant strategy calls, you know, I was a part of all those. But then even within that, there's a smaller group that has other conversations. And I would argue that that group still doesn't have nearly enough digital representation and often none. So there's still issues there, and I think that remains.
So you get a campaign manager, a media consultant, a pollster, and the candidate or something.
And maybe the
reacting to a really big event without, say, someone like you in the room.
Yeah. I think, and then there are some situations where they know that we've had on some campaigns where it's a relatively small, I've been on a couple where it's a relatively small group of people, and then you're a part of all those conversations. But I have no illusions that there are still other conversations that happen that would benefit from just my perspective or our perspective as strategists. We may have digital expertise, but it doesn't mean that we haven't been doing politics for 15 years.
Right.
Right? You have campaign managers who've been doing it for 2 or 3 years, and you're supposed to tell me that they've got a better sense of things than sort of, and not worth getting advice for someone who's been doing it for 15 years. I don't care what the expertise is, right? But I think it gets siloed sometimes in the same way that, at least early on, it was so fundraising focused. So it got siloed in the way that a fundraiser gets siloed early on. That changed as you got more into communications and persuasion.
You said something about like the candidate's politics make a big difference online. You know, mm-hmm. the difference between Barbara Boxer and Blanche Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
What in general makes a candidate that is easy to work for as a digital consultant.
Yeah, easy in the sense that...
And easy in the sense that they're going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Well, look at Blanche's politics and Barbara's politics. Barbara's a liberal senator and is aggressive on issues. So Barbara's ascendancy online came with one show in the base, and really important in that era as being having been against the war, right? Really big piece of it. She's against the war, oppositional to the Bush administration. Our big online moment where it sort of really took off and actually started getting other senators' attentions about the importance of digital organizing. Barbara, we did it through her PAC for a Change. She was like, I'm really going to go after Condoleezza Rice and these confirmation hearings. And I want the truth. And I just want the truth. It was that simple. And that's all we did. We then took what the senator was already going to do. We worked together and came up with a plan with the team. Just do a simple online petition. Just like tell the truth. It wasn't that complicated. But there were so few during that time willing to even go there and be that oppositional. I think a lot of people felt defeated after the 2004 campaign, but Barbara was ready to fight. She wasn't going to sort of sit back. So she was ready to fight. She has a very simple message. And then when it came to confirmation hearing, she delivered. She had an SNL skit about it, right? It just sort of like, it just went all the way there. So that willingness to represent people's voices who feel like they're not being represented, who are upset, angry, want to speak out. And she gave them a mechanism to do that online. That was a really eye-opening moment for me. I think eye-opening moment for the senator and then her colleagues who started seeing like, what is going on here? And then she builds this community via that action and is able then, what speaks very loudly to her colleagues, raise money for them. They're like, where's this money coming from? Who are you getting these tens of thousands of people to all of a sudden give me like $20, $15? And so the growth of small donors and the power that it generated, certainly before super PACs as well, it's really important. That changed the dynamics very significantly. And it was because she's willing to take a more confrontational position, represent progressives who felt like, oh my God, we just lost to George W. Bush. Like, where are we? We're out in the wilderness. She gave them that vehicle. That is important online. People are looking to be represented. And the folks most active online tend to be the most partisan. I don't think we fully realized that at first. But over time, that's become true.
So when you have a candidate like a Blanche Lincoln, who is running in a much more conservative state than California and is positioned in a more conservative way. There are conservative Democrats in the electorate also.
Yeah.
How do you then find them and get support for someone like that?
Yeah, no, and that's, it's a different angle, right? There are plenty of people who gave to Senator Lincoln, progressives will give to Senator Lincoln for a couple of different reasons, not least of which is if she's in a tough race and it's a Democrat,
they
it's
win
D
it.
Versus R,
yeah.
They're giving to the D.
Yeah.
They understand that if you want, hey, Barbara Boxer may represent me in California, but Barbara Boxer has a lot more power to push things through if she's in the majority. Yeah. Or the Senate has a lot more power to slow down George W. Bush if they're in the majority, as we've seen. There's an electability argument. The other piece of online is it was important for the Lincoln campaign just to build relationships with people. And it was another mechanism of just organizing. It just happens to be digital. So these are still your voters. They're still Democratic partisans and voters in Arkansas who need to hear from you and may not be hearing from you yet on TV or any other paid media. So building that community is important. And it's just another way of building a community, ultimately sourcing volunteers and some donors. We're never going to raise as much for Blanche Lincoln as we did for Barbara Boxer. But if she had gotten in a situation where her race was going to be tough, the list that we grew for them and the community we built for Senator Lincoln, we would have been able to raise significant money. And then General Clark could have raised a lot of money from his national list for Blanche Lincoln because of it's the seat at some point.
Yeah. So. This trend, this ability to raise money and get attention from the base, from the most active members of both parties,
mm-hmm.
has, I think, had consequences
for
our politics,
yes.
Right? Has kind of accelerated the division between the parties, has affected the national discourse and probably made the pitched battle a little more divisive. And maybe that's led to some bad consequences. How do you see the politics changing as a result of what's happening in digital politics?
I think it's complicated. I don't think it's an issue of just about partisans. I think there are situations where, as we've seen social media and social media feeds, where you just basically get fed people in your feed that are reinforcing to your worldview versus...
your bubble.
Yeah, it's your bubble. You're, as Eli Freezer says, it's your filter bubble, right? So that's a part of it. The most partisan, I think, do shout louder, but I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. There are also, has democratized things in a sense that it has allowed more voices. People can argue that younger folks and people of color who have been provided a greater voice because, let's be honest, in politics, it's pretty damn white. And a mechanism that is more accessible to allow people to speak up, it's ultimately good for our politics. The questions of sort of people picking their sides and staying there and not talking to each other, it's no more a function of digital than I would say like partisan media like Fox, right? Fox has done more to polarize than any other channel or platform, in my opinion, right? It's and then what happens when that has started and that got to a fever pitch, people feel like they have to speak up against that, right? And so then people do get in their corners. But let's not forget a significant part of that genesis comes from actually traditional media and Fox specifically. So, and it continues, right? They set a lot of narrative and agenda. It filters its way online and people fight against that as they should. But it does start there. The internet is a great thing. It has negative things as well, and I don't pretend to do that. There are some folks who approach digital organizing in a very specific lens, which is to get people to foam as much as possible, to be as short-term oriented as possible, and that can have short-term benefits. I don't think that's a question. It is not how we approach things. We believe that your narrative and your brand and building relationship matters, and that in the long run, that's going to benefit you. Whether it's fundraising, whether it's organizing, whether it's volunteers, whether it's votes, that you can't be one person here online and be like, you know, have this very transactional behavior and then expect to then go to the voters and be like a senator and, you know, a statesperson. We just don't approach it that way. So we try to be much more, not any less progressive in our worldview, and in some ways not less urgent, but the heat's different. It's a slightly different approach.
I don't know how many cycles you ran as BlackRock, but at some point you decide to pull three firms together.
Yeah.
And I guess that's where the name Trilogy must be coming from.
Picking a name is awful, but yes.
Picking a name is difficult. Tell me about that merger and how that changed things for you.
We knew Josh was running at the time Mayfield. You knew Josh, and Josh had run into Josh a little bit. He was doing the same work we were doing.
And he had done Kerry in the same time you were doing Clark, and then had formed Mayfield and done a bunch of other statewide races through that and was also thriving in the space.
Yes. And then they had also a tool set that they used. And then Randy and Stacy were running Articulated Man. And Articulated Man, both Josh, Brent, and my firm, we would use
design
Randy
firm.
And Stacy to do our design work. Yeah. Our website design, we worked on a couple of different projects right away. First race, Brent and I did after the 2004 elections, which was really important, right? It shows some viability because we actually got income in the off year. We started working for Antonio Villaraigosa in LA when he was running for mayor, and we're like, great, we actually have work now. So that was really important. But we had worked with Randy. Randy was doing some work on another project we had been on, and then we reached out to Randy to do the website for Antonio in 2004, 2005. So then we just built a relationship. Anytime I needed a website, I went to Randy. And then Josh was in the Bay Area, and we just start talking at some point, how would this fit together? What are the different strengths of the firms? Are they complementary? It looked to be mostly complementary pieces. So we decide to put it all together in 2010. So it's almost 10 years, actually.
It is notably difficult in many cases to form partnerships and to negotiate those relationships and to make things fair and keep people on board. And you have had a good run now. How did you guys work that out in a way that was sustainable?
I think we're all pretty reasonable. Mm-hmm. We try to look at the numbers, but at the same time, not be beholden to it. And you understand that when you run a business, it's more complicated than P&Ls. And at some point, there's going to have to be a little give and get. And people have to be okay with that and have conversations about it. We could always be more open and honest, especially when you're friends, right? You don't want to damage that relationship. And that's good because you can be in some ways much more thoughtful and considerate and be willing to compromise when you need to, which you need to be able to do. The flip side of that is if you give into that too much, then it can get out of balance. So it's balancing those pieces within you. It still all starts with respect for each other, respecting what the other person brings to the table that you may not bring to the table, understanding that you don't run the whole thing on your own and that you benefit from that. There are plenty of things I don't want to do in a partnership. And it's good because I'm probably not very good at it. I don't want to do it. And part of why I don't want to do it is I'm not very good at it. And there are folks who do that. There are things that I do that are better than other folks, and they have to value that. Look, it's a push and pull. It still comes from respect. If you respect each other and you honor each other, then you can usually make it work. But it works for now.
What has been your role, would you say, in Trilogy?
The part of the business that has evolved greatly, the role of digital in general in campaigns, has been how my role, my sort of work has evolved, where it was so heavily email fundraising at the beginning. Advertising starts to seep into things in 2006, mostly in direct response. 2008, first set of persuasion advertising starts happening in digital. And that has evolved over time. So as digital has become just as important as a paid media platform, as well as a communications platform, and not just about fundraising, that's my day-to-day has evolved. I help run the practice that is focused on the strategy and communications and advertising work. And I do a fair amount of the outreach and business development because of that. So that's certainly a bigger area of focus for me. Probably that requires the largest team. And so I get a lot of help both from other partners as well as other folks on the team from the operational perspective, because it's not an interest of mine. I like doing the work. I like working with my teams, but I don't like to deal with operations or even to a lesser extent process. So other people can help me with that and help the team with that because it's necessary to run a business.
There are now quite a number of other digital consultancies, digital fundraisers, people who intersect or compete with you. Mm-hmm. And some of them have built advertising practices on the side. How do you distinguish what you guys do at Trilogy with some of the others in the space?
We start with the fact that we are strategists and advisors. We just happen to have an expertise in digital. And that's really important. And selling the product is fine. If you're just trying to sell media buying, or you're selling just a website, or you're just... that can be done. What you get from us is a more comprehensive view of how it should work and how it should fit together. And the solutions are custom because of that. They aren't just sort of because of whether it's the creative that comes out of that strategic advising, whether it's the style of website that and what it emphasizes on the website, whether it's the type of email program, whether it's focused on organizing versus fundraising versus just outreach. That is all affected by how we think about the project. It has to start there. It is far from cookie cutter. And it's not because I don't think I'd do the business. I wouldn't do the work if it has to be cookie cutter. Somebody else can do that. And there's plenty of appetite for that. There's plenty of need for that. Many campaigns are notoriously cheap to a fault. But with that, then the customization that you get from that has to decrease. You're just gonna, it's a continuum. Like, you want it more custom, you want it to be more specialized to you, it takes more time. If it takes more time, it's gonna cost more. If you don't want to spend that much money and you want to do something else, then you're gonna get a different kind of product. There's a market for that, and that's fine. Our market's gonna value that customization, that strategy, and that overall viewpoint, and how we put the pieces together. And our differentiation starts there, and then the differentiation down the line is that we actually have the capacity internally to then execute it. We don't have to outsource it to people and give it to other people and then take a cut. We actually take pride in how we put it together, and we train the team to be able to put it together.
So who's an ideal client for you?
The ideal client for us, for me personally, has to start with how they view the world, which is that while we understand some things, we know that there's a lot we don't know. And that more expansive view of the world allows us to actually learn. So why am I doing this if I don't actually learn something along the way? And then ultimately get better at it and get a good result for the client. So to do that, most of the time they do actually have to have a decent sized budget. It doesn't have to be like ginormous. I'm not talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions, but enough to let us invest to learn. And that means giving us some runway to test and try different things. And so my ideal client ultimately looks at digital as an holistic thing that is integrated into a campaign that allows me to be, we mentioned earlier, be at the table, that small group of advisors, so that we have real input in where things go, not just as digital folks, but just as strategists. They allow us to think about the solution that they want and bring the necessary pieces forward to execute that. And usually that means, hopefully, it allows us to use the full weight of the firm. So we have great experts in things as niche as email deliverability and really database management. But then I want someone, a campaign that lets us, or a nonprofit that lets us bring our design chops to us, our advertising chops, our email chops, all those things together, and let us work it all. Because then there's so much opportunity for the sum of the parts to be much greater than the whole. And then within that, there's so many different levers you get to pull, because you don't know what is the key piece to adjust to maximize a program. So allowing us to have all these things and all these tools allows me as just the general strategist of it all to really scan where the opportunities are. The opportunities really can be different on a day-to-day basis depending on what's happening. That's fun. That's exciting.
Who are you working for now?
Our firms in general has had all these long-term relationships with a couple big nonprofits. We continue to do a lot of work with folks like Wikimedia and USO. For me, I've been doing, have some really great clients like this nonprofit that started relatively recently in the called Patients for Affordable Drugs. They work on representing patients in the fight to get more reasonable drug prices. And it's really important work. The storytelling is really powerful. It's really exciting. We have some other traditional clients. We work with the Carpenters. And so those tend to be all left-leaning, but really interesting stories for all of them to tell and different problems to solve. I've had a long relationship with Governor Inslee. So I just finished working on the presidential campaign. And obviously, he's transitioned to run for another term for governor in Washington State. So we continue to do work with Jay as well.
Are you doing other Senate races or
We continue to have conversations about the how we're going to play mm-hmm. in the next election cycle. So yeah. So that will continue. I'm sure we'll be involved. Yeah. Just how what that looks like exactly.
And was Inslee your only presidential?
Yes, we did have a part of the firm that was firewalled off, who didn't touch that campaign at all. We kept them clean, but that was mm-hmm. the only one we worked on.
What's making you most excited these days about the work?
I think the opportunity to continue to change paid media and digital's growing role in that, and how it will be important in terms of building winning campaigns using digital, that digital has not just more of a seat at the table, but the ability to have a little bit more of its own agency in determining what's important. That's exciting, and it won't happen on every project I work on, but there are going to be more and more, I've seen it every cycle, that allows digital to really push and innovate and go where the world is, right? In campaigns, we are just trying to get to where the rest of the world is. And the power of incumbency in terms of how campaigns are run, or tradition in terms of how campaigns are run, it's really powerful, and we're continuing to work against that every time. And it's just a little bit forward every 2 years.
Essentially on that subject, and in the nature of digital strategists being in the room, the Trump campaign picked their digital strategist as campaign manager, which is a pretty telling thing. I wonder how you kind of view that. What are your thoughts about Trump in the space?
Well, I mean, it's always hard to make sure you sort of pierce through every side
the
that
puffery.
Wins. Yeah, every side that wins is full of geniuses,
yes.
And every side that loses is full of idiots and full of mistakes. And we know that it's always somewhere in between. But they did do some things that were innovative, and they did some things that were important because they understood the landscape they were in and what they had the ability to do. Would they have spent as much money on digital if they had more money? They probably would have spent more money on TV if they had more money. They just didn't have as much money as the Clinton campaign. So they rightly, I think, thought, okay, well, how do we become more efficient with these dollars?
There's sometimes a real virtue to insurgency.
Absolutely. Hey, we talked about the 2003-2004. The reason Democrats grew in sort of the digital organizing space was we were on the outside.
Yeah, you have to scrap.
Yeah, you have to. Like, I've always had this belief in that the parties out of power or the individuals out of power must be the ones who innovate, because they feel like they have to try to win again and get back in the spot. So they did some things that I thought were smart, in which we continue to encourage our clients to do, which is, and it is the benefit when you're running a national campaign, field testing, right? They put their ads out, they tested the ads, and then they deployed. And they did that online first. There is no reason more organizations, more campaigns shouldn't do that. The only reason they don't is because they are stuck in the old way of doing things. And they are stuck by having the same advisors tell them the same things over and over again. And because of that, change has been slow on our side. The GOP has been better about investing in digital early and spending more as a percentage of their media buy. And yet, in some ways, certain voter segments for the Democrats are even more represented online, yet we haven't done the same things. Right? Whether it's young folks, communities of color.
If you could get the relevant Democrats in a room and knock their heads together and say, you ought to change in this way, what would be the ways that we ought to be changing how we conduct our campaigning?
Right. You need to stop having advisors that have conflicts of interest. I don't think it's fair if I were replacing what used to be the general consultant on a campaign and yet represent my digital interests, right?
So
because
like,
I would make more money if more money gets spent on digital. And how?
So you're talking about the TV ad people.
It's not always TV, right? Because sometimes the person who's the GC can be a male person or a pollster, and they have their own
biases.
They're
buying their own services.
Right, and they have their own biases, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's hard. It's human nature. Yeah. It's hard to separate that. It is not a personal attack. So if you're listening to this and you think it's a personal attack, you have to question why you think it's a personal attack.
Yeah.
Because it's just human nature. So the decline of the general consultant, I think, has been a bad thing in that sense. Because in reality, what you want is an integrated approach. Sometimes TV is the right answer. Or at least the bulk of the answer, right? And sometimes it's not. 99% of campaigns decide that TV is the answer. That cannot be true, given that most races aren't even statewide. And most races are like local races that have really terrible TV markets, right? And you're spending, and so, no, it has to be more complicated than that. So I would get there and be like, how do you make decisions on campaigns? What are you optimizing for? Think about it. Are you optimizing for spending on TV, which is different than optimizing to reach voters? That's not the same thing.
Do you think that's sorting out to a difference in winning and losing?
Yeah, look, ultimately, the biggest driver to winning and losing are these macro things. So let's not pretend. This is what I get to at the beginning. It's like, we all think we're smarter than we are.
We're only making a difference on the margin.
Yeah, we are making a difference on the margins, but the margins matter, right? When races are close, and many races are close, it matters. It also matters from my perspective. If you say it makes a difference, I think it makes a difference. Yes, I think we would win more races if we just changed our approach. I think ultimately it probably would mean less on broadcast TV. I'm not saying less TV. I'm saying smarter TV. Yeah. I'm saying smarter digital. I'm saying smarter mail. I'm saying smarter polling and research. There are all kinds of things here that need to be improved. But that is not how people make decisions right now. It isn't because it's stuck in old ways. So yeah, I think we would win more races. I think we would also win more races long term, in the sense that if we are smarter about who we reach out to, we are smarter about who's actually available to vote, I believe we would touch more people. We would build a larger base of support. That idea of who the regular voter becomes less old, less white when that happens. Why do we think only old and white people vote? Well, we only talk to old and white people, and we just assume that's always going to be the case. So if you never give this person a chance to listen to you, why would they get off the couch? You're not talking to them. And if we always do things the old way, that just reinforces it. So yeah, I think it changes it. I think it changes it long term. We benefit from a larger and more diverse electorate as Democrats. And we need to do more in our campaigns, in our organizing work, in our sort of nonprofit work to make sure we're doing that. Not just optimize for today, but think about it long term.
To take you back to Trump and the 2020 election.
Yeah. I like what they're doing.
You like what the Trumpist folks are doing? Or you like what we're doing on our side?
I think both sides have their virtues. I like what Trump's doing, what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And for what they do,
what is it that they're doing that you're seeing?
They're field testing a lot. They're putting a lot of stuff out there and just seeing how people react to it. Now, the question I would have is like, who do they care about?
Well, they're identifying who they can press. Yeah. To get out, ultimately. Yeah, right. They're working on lots of ways to do that, as I understand.
So the question, yes, exactly. And so they are working hard, I think, to solidify that base of support as much as possible.
And motivate them.
And motivate them and lock them in, which I think will be important.
And also go after some of our, so the, like the break question, off some of our.
So the question is, how are they going after to break off some of the folks that may lean Democratic or left-leaning independents? I have less visibility into that. They will have challenges in that because they still have the macro effects of how this guy's acting. It's very off-putting. And what they benefited from in 16 was like, people were like, well, you don't know what he's really going to be like. This is kind of like performance art. And so the reality is different than performance art, right? This is a show. And then someone gets in. And then now they realize the show is the reality.
Well, they have to decide whether to cancel the show authorize more episodes, because it's been pretty entertaining.
Right. And so it's an interesting thing of like how they're doing that. I do like the fact that the way they're testing it is in live environments. That's interesting. That's more typical of what brands do.
If we get a nominee and you are pulled into the circle that we're trying to advise, how would you contend with, you know, you got a president who can generate earned media to any extent, who can type a couple words and get covered by everybody immediately. How would you contend with that from the point of view of a strategist for a Democratic nominee?
You have to be you first. You have to establish who you are to withstand what will be constant and attacks.
To change you.
To change you and change people's idea of you. So it is actually really important for the nominee to establish themselves first and build their own narrative from my perspective. Because if you have a strong foundation, it's a lot harder to knock you off of it. And if you're going to chase constantly, that means you stand nowhere. And then it's easy to define you.
Who do you think is doing a good job of that now?
I think it's clear Elizabeth Warren's doing that, right? She's always been this way. And I profess to having a personal affection for Elizabeth. Just, we worked on her 2012 Senate race, and it was a great experience. And I also have a lot of friends who have known her from the law school, took her classes. And it's been universal praise for who she is as a person, who she is as a teacher. And that gets reflected on the campaign trail. It is not different. That's easy, right? It's great to be able to run as a candidate as the person you are, because it's authentic and it's easy to do.
And a lot of people have had to not do that, like McCain or someone running to the right of where he was.
And then you can feel that. Awkward. And you can feel it. Yeah. And people can feel it. They can't always articulate what it is, but they can feel it. So yeah, I think Elizabeth's doing a great job. She has a narrative. She has a view of the world. She leans into it. That's going to be her foundation. Doesn't mean she's not going to be attacked. Doesn't mean that she can't get off her game, because she will be. That's going to happen. It's a campaign. But at her core, and the people who like love her at her core are going to be with her because they understand that.
I wonder if there's one question that you would like to be asked in an interview like this that you haven't been.
Oh, man, that's a great question. Ultimately, the question that everyone should get asked in anything that they do, I think, is why do you keep doing it?
Why do you keep doing this? You've been doing it a long time.
Yeah, it's been a long time. It matters.
Yeah.
I'm not where I am without America.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
And the country's, in a certain way, the definition of the country's in the balance right now.
Right. And the fundamental principles of what America's supposed to be is why my parents left Vietnam and came here, and how they've been able to have 5 successful kids, who, by the way, were on welfare and WIC and had free lunch program and all those things. But how do you survive without some of that? Because the country's bigger than that. And so if the question is today whether our country is still big enough in our hearts to do that for people, then it matters.
It couldn't matter more. It's a pivotal moment, I think.
Absolutely.
Larry, it's been a real honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
No, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Bye. That was Larry Huynh of Trilogy Interactive. He's at trilogyinteractive.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.